Economics isn't just about numbers and graphs. It's the story of human survival, cooperation, and progress. Niall Kishtany's A Little History of Economics has become a cultural phenomenon, praised by figures from Bill Gates to Nobel laureates for its remarkable ability to make complex economic ideas accessible without sacrificing depth. The book has sold over 1 million copies worldwide and been translated into 25 languages, becoming required reading in universities across the globe. What makes this particular economic history so compelling is Kishtany's talent for revealing the human drama behind economic theories, showing how ideas that shape our world today emerged from the personal experiences, moral dilemmas, and historical crises faced by thinkers throughout history. As we navigate today's economic uncertainties, understanding this intellectual journey has never been more relevant. Like all humans throughout history, our earliest ancestors faced the fundamental economic problem, scarcity. Hunter-gatherers foraged for food in forests, living day to day with little surplus. But around 10,000 years ago, the first economic revolution occurred. Agriculture emerged, allowing people to cluster in villages and produce more food than they immediately needed. This surplus production became the foundation for civilization itself. In Mesopotamia, this new economic complexity required organization. Early writing systems developed primarily to track the distribution of resources. Who owned what? Who owed what? As societies grew more complex, philosophers began questioning how resources should be allocated and what constituted a good economic system. The ancient Greeks pioneered formal economic thought. Hesiod observed that gods keep men's food concealed, recognizing that humans must work to survive, perhaps the first articulation of scarcity as an economic principle. Plato imagined an ideal republic where people's roles were determined at birth, with philosopher kings ruling and little room for markets or commerce. He distrusted wealth pursuit, believing it would corrupt society and lead to conflict. His student Aristotle took a more practical approach. He criticized Plato's communal property plan, arguing that private ownership actually reduced disputes since people take better care of what belongs to them personally, an insight that would resurface throughout economic history. Aristotle identified exchange as the fundamental economic particle and viewed money as a measuring rod of value. While he considered households selling their surpluses natural, he drew a sharp distinction between this and commerce purely for profit, which he deemed unnatural. Money lending was, in his view, the worst economic activity of all. Money breeding money violated natural order. Despite philosophers' warnings, commerce flourished as Greek city-states faced economic pressures. Trade expanded dramatically under Alexander the Great's empire, creating vast networks of exchange. After Rome's fall, economic thought continued developing through an unexpected source, Christian monks in European monasteries, who would build upon and transform these classical foundations. Medieval economic thought was deeply intertwined with Christian theology. The Bible portrayed work as humanity's punishment following Adam and Eve's sin, while Jesus warned that pursuing wealth could lead people away from God. These religious principles formed the foundation for economic thinking throughout the Middle Ages. Thomas Aquinas, perhaps the most influential medieval thinker, developed economic concepts that reflected Christian morality. His idea of the just price wasn't the highest possible price a seller could extract, but rather what was normally charged without deception or market domination. This concept recognized that while exchange required both parties to benefit, Christian ethics demanded fairness rather than maximum profit. Aquinas strongly condemned usury, lending money for interest, as a form of theft. His reasoning was theological and philosophical. Money was barren and couldn't reproduce naturally like livestock or crops. Money's proper use was for buying and selling, not for breeding through interest. When you lend someone $100 and demand $110 back, where does that extra $10 come from? To Aquinas, it represented an unnatural extraction from the borrower. However, as Europe rediscovered trade and commerce, with cities like Venice and Florence flourishing through international exchange, medieval society evolved beyond the simple chain of being. The traditional social order of those who prayed, clergy, those who fought, nobility, and those who worked, peasants, expanded to include merchants and bankers. As trade expanded, financial innovations developed naturally. Merchants stored coins with money changers, who facilitated transfers between accounts and provided loans, effectively becoming the first bankers. Insurance emerged to manage shipping risks. The church gradually softened its stance on interest, recognizing that reasonable rates were necessary for banking to function. By the late medieval period, the idea that wealth and godliness were incompatible began fading. Merchants increasingly believed they could serve both God and profit, a significant shift that would open the door to modern capitalism while maintaining some ethical constraints on economic behavior. In 1581, Queen Elizabeth I knighted Francis Drake after his voyage plundering Spanish ships, a moment that perfectly symbolized the alliance between monarchs and merchants that defined mercantilism. This economic system emerged as thinkers turned from medieval religious frameworks toward reason and science, with practical people like Gerard de Molines and Thomas Munn writing about national wealth creation. Mercantilists believed a nation's wealth was measured in gold and silver. While later economists would criticize this as the Midas fallacy, gold was indeed essential in an era when it was the only way to buy things and finance armies. Molines advocated restricting gold outflows through strict regulation, while Munn argued the best approach was achieving a favorable trade balance by selling more goods to foreigners than buying from them. Governments actively encouraged exports through taxes on imports and sumptuary laws banning expensive foreign products. They established trading companies like the English East India Company that helped build empires. This system wasn't about individual prosperity, but national power. Economics became a tool of statecraft. Adam Smith later criticized mercantilism for favoring merchants over workers and failing to recognize that both sides benefit in trade. By the late 18th century, mercantilism declined as Britain's American colonies broke away, ending guaranteed markets and challenging the notion that trade must always benefit one nation at another's expense. The mercantilists bridged medieval and industrial economies, emphasizing money over moral concerns. As Edmund Burke lamented in 1790, the age of chivalry is gone. That of economists and calculators has succeeded. This shift toward viewing economics as a science rather than a moral discipline would accelerate with the Enlightenment and the dawn of classical economics. In France, François Quesnay led the world's first formal school of economists, the Physiocrats. Unlike mercantilists who saw gold as wealth, Quesnay believed agriculture was the ultimate source of a nation's prosperity, the foundation of physiocracy, or rule by nature. He created the first economic model, the tableau économique, showing how resources circulated between farmers, landowners, and craftsmen. Though revolutionary in locating economic value in real goods rather than money alone, Quesnay's exclusive focus on agriculture as the source of value would soon be challenged by the Industrial Revolution. Adam Smith, the Scottish philosopher often called the father of modern economics, posed a revolutionary question in his 1776 masterwork, The Wealth of Nations. Is self-interest compatible with a good society? Challenging conventional wisdom, Smith argued that society thrives when people act in their own self-interest rather than from benevolence. It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, Smith famously wrote, but from their regard to their own interest. This insight introduced the concept of the invisible hand, the idea that without central direction, individuals pursuing their own interests naturally promote social harmony through market exchanges. This system works best, Smith emphasized, when people maintain honesty and reliability, not through pure selfishness. His theory wasn't a celebration of greed, but a recognition that properly channeled self-interest could benefit society as a whole. Smith noted that humans' unique tendency to exchange goods leads to specialization and division of labor, creating mutual benefits as people focus on what they do best. Smith's contemporary, David Ricardo, further developed these ideas while addressing the economic challenges of industrializing Britain. As a successful stockbroker who became wealthy through government loans during the Napoleonic Wars, Ricardo applied his logical mind to analyze how Britain's growing wealth should be divided between landowners, capitalists, and workers. Ricardo argued that high food prices caused high land rents, not vice versa, allowing landlords to capture the nation's wealth at everyone's expense. Using his giant farm model, Ricardo demonstrated how population growth forced farming on less fertile land, raising grain prices and landlords' rents while reducing capitalist profits and workers' purchasing power. Ricardo opposed Britain's corn laws, which banned cheap foreign grain imports, arguing they enriched landlords while impoverishing workers and reducing capitalist profits. As a member of Parliament, he advocated repealing these laws to allow cheap foreign grain imports, lower food prices, increase capitalist profits, and accelerate wealth creation. His most enduring contribution was the theory of comparative advantage, showing how countries benefit from trade even when one is better at producing everything. Just as two friends should divide chores based on relative efficiency, countries should specialize in what they produce relatively best, then trade. This principle became one of economics' most cherished ideas, suggesting all nations can gain through specialization and open borders. Victor Hugo's character Fantine from Les Misérables represented countless victims of industrial capitalism who suffered not from personal failings, but from a cruel economic system. Despite the Industrial Revolution creating unprecedented wealth, many lived in deep poverty, with children working long factory hours, disease rampant in overcrowded cities, and the poorest relegated to harsh workhouses. People began questioning whether the poor were truly responsible for their own misfortunes. While Smith and Ricardo believed capitalism meant progress despite its flaws, a different group of thinkers despaired at industrial society's squalor and sought to create entirely new social systems. Charles Fourier envisioned phalansteries, where people could follow their passions in carefully organized groups rather than performing monotonous factory tasks. Robert Owen, a successful industrialist, established model communities at New Lanark and New Harmony based on his belief that good environments produced good people. Henri de Saint-Simon proposed a society ruled by talented scientists and industrialists rather than aristocrats, directing the economy as a unified workshop. These early socialists, while influential, were criticized by Marx as dreamers who naively believed change could come through goodwill rather than revolution. Their utopian visions reflected a growing recognition that industrial capitalism, for all its productive power, was creating new forms of human suffering that demanded response. Thomas Malthus, the first economics professor, gained fame for his pessimistic theory that population growth inevitably leads to poverty. Unlike earlier thinkers who saw large populations as beneficial, Malthus argued that humans' need for food, combined with their reproductive drive, created an unsolvable problem. He claimed population grows geometrically while food production increases only arithmetically, ensuring that population will always outstrip resources. The result? Either misery, famine and disease, or vice, contraception, abortion, would check population growth. Even new resources would only temporarily improve living standards before population increased and returned people to subsistence levels. Malthus's grim theory led him to oppose poor relief, arguing charity merely creating more miserable beggars. His views earned economics the nickname the Dismal Science and provoked fierce criticism from thinkers like Marx, who called it a libel on the human race. Marx and Engels opened the Communist Manifesto with the famous line, "A specter is haunting Europe." the specter of communism, announcing their revolutionary vision of history as class struggle. After witnessing the 1848 Paris uprisings, Marx retreated to London, where he spent 20 years writing his masterwork Capital while suffering from carbuncles and financial hardship. His economic theory centered on exploitation. Capitalists extract surplus value from workers who produce more value than their subsistence wages. Imagine a worker who creates $100 worth of goods daily but receives only $50 in wages. The remaining $50 is surplus value appropriated by the capitalist. This fundamental contradiction, workers creating wealth they cannot afford to buy, would eventually collapse capitalism as workers seize the means of production. Unlike utopians who relied on human kindness, Marx saw capitalism's internal contradictions as the engine of revolution. His critique extended beyond material deprivation to alienation, where workers become disconnected from their labor and humanity. In pre-industrial times, craftspeople controlled their work process and saw themselves in their creations. Under industrial capitalism, workers became mere appendages to machines, performing repetitive tasks with no connection to the final product. Though communist regimes later failed, Marx's analysis of capitalism's tensions remains influential, ending with his rallying cry, "Working men of all countries, unite!" As Marx was developing his labor theory of value, other economists were approaching value from a completely different angle. William Jevons introduced marginal utility, the idea that each additional unit of consumption provides diminishing pleasure. This concept explains consumer behavior. We balance our spending to equalize marginal utility across different goods. Alfred Marshall expanded these ideas into the law of demand, lower prices increase demand, and developed supply and demand theory, where market equilibrium occurs when quantity demanded equals quantity supplied. Marshall's neoclassical economics introduced rational economic man, who makes decisions by weighing marginal costs and benefits, a view that presented markets as harmonious rather than exploitative, as Marx had argued. The chapter illustrates how businesses often seek protection from foreign competition through tariffs. Friedrich List argued that infant industries require temporary protection from established foreign competitors until they mature enough to compete globally, similar to nurturing children before they face adult responsibilities. List believed free trade was beneficial only between countries at similar development stages, criticizing British economists for their cosmopolitanism that assumed economic theories applied universally. Despite the 19th century being called the era of free trade, protection remained common, and sometimes free trade was established through force, as when Britain forced China to open its markets. Modern economists generally favor Smith and Ricardo's free trade views over List's protectionism, believing protection rewards inefficiency. Vladimir Lenin connected capitalism to imperialism, arguing that monopoly capitalism created excess savings among the wealthy that couldn't be profitably invested domestically. This drove imperial powers to invade foreign territories, establishing colonies where capitalists could build factories and sell goods they couldn't sell at home. John Hobson called this excess saving the economic taproot of imperialism, explaining why capitalism hadn't collapsed as Marx predicted. Lenin's 1916 pamphlet, Imperialism, the Highest Stage of Capitalism, argued that capitalism and private property made war inevitable. He believed workers weren't revolting because monopoly profits allowed firms to pay higher wages, creating an aristocracy of labor content with capitalism. Though Lenin and Hobson viewed imperialism as capitalism's death throes, in reality, Europe's economies were thriving. Arthur Cecil Pigou, a brilliant but eccentric Cambridge economist, pioneered welfare economics by examining how markets can fail despite capitalism's general success. He showed that markets often lead people to make choices with damaging side effects on others. when someone's actions create externalities that affect others, like a neighbor's trumpet playing causing headaches or factories polluting rivers, there's a gap between private costs, what individuals pay for, and social costs, the total impact on society. This leads markets to produce too much of harmful things and too little of beneficial ones. Pigou argued governments should correct these failures through taxes on negative externalities, like pollution, and subsidies for positive ones, like research. For public goods that benefit everyone regardless of payment, like street lighting, government provision may be necessary. Edward Chamberlain showed how advertising helps firms distinguish their products from competitors, often by creating desirable brand images rather than highlighting actual product characteristics. Whitman's 1920s chocolate advertisements, for example, featured fashionable people with luxury cars rather than describing taste. This monopolistic competition represents a gray area between pure competition and monopoly. While consumers benefit from variety, choosing between Coke, Pepsi, and other drinks, critics question whether society truly needs endless, slightly differentiated products marketed through expensive campaigns. Joan Robinson later became critical of conventional economics, famously stating that the purpose of studying economics is to learn how to avoid being deceived by economists. She resisted the trend toward complex mathematics, explored the concept of monopsony, where a single buyer controls a market, and used traditional economic methods to argue for minimum wages and strong unions. Forstein Veblen, America's most unconventional economist, critiqued the gaudy consumption of America's Gilded Age with outsider's clarity. Raised on a Wisconsin farm by Norwegian immigrants, this eccentric scholar analyzed how industrialization created a new leisure class that flaunted wealth through what he called conspicuous consumption. Unlike conventional economists who viewed people as rational utility maximizers, Veblen argued that consumption patterns stemmed from instincts and habits shaped by culture. The wealthy displayed their status through impractical possessions and leisure activities, demonstrating they didn't need to work. Women's restrictive clothing deliberately hampers the wearer at every turn, proving they never needed to perform manual labor. This status seeking trickled down to all classes, creating a wasteful treadmill of dissatisfaction where everyone constantly strives to keep up appearances. By 1933, America's economic collapse had left 13 million people unemployed, a quarter of all workers, with some cities seeing half their workforce jobless. The Great Depression transformed America's railways into carriers of desperate job seekers, while homeless families built makeshift shacks from scrap materials. How could the world's richest nation fall so far? John Maynard Keynes, the brilliant British economist, described by Virginia Woolf as like a gorged seal with extraordinary intellect, argued that conventional economics couldn't explain this crisis. Traditional economic theory assumed economies always operated at full capacity, with scarce resources. To make more boots meant making fewer hats. But Keynes recognized a different reality. America's industrial production had halved, while millions of workers sat idle. The problem wasn't scarcity, but a broken connection between what people wanted and what the economy produced. Keynes rejected Say's law, which held that everything made would eventually sell, because producers only make goods to exchange for other goods. This conventional view made recessions theoretically impossible. Bootmakers sell boots to buy coats, hat makers sell hats to buy boots, so supply should always create its own demand. Keynes illustrated the economy as a bathtub, where spending is the water level. Say's law assumes savings, water flowing down the plug hole, always return as investment, water flowing back through a tap. But Keynes argued this connection was broken. Savings might disappear under mattresses rather than becoming investments. When businesses feel gloomy and stop investing, spending drops, factories produce less, workers get sacked, and recession follows. Unlike conventional economists who believed economies would self-correct like roly-poly toys, Keynes saw economies could get stuck in depression. His ideas transformed economics, dividing it into macroeconomics, studying whole economies, and microeconomics, studying individual choices. Most importantly, Keynes showed that government intervention was necessary to rescue capitalism from its own flaws, forever changing the role of government in economic management. Joseph Schumpeter, the brilliant Austrian economist who claimed to have achieved two of his three ambitions, being the greatest economist in the world and the best lover in Vienna, though things hadn't been going so well with the horses lately, embodied a fascinating contradiction. He combined old-world aristocratic manners with cutting-edge economic theory. Schumpeter's vision of capitalism centered on entrepreneurs, modern versions of swashbuckling knights who create wealth through innovation. Unlike Veblen, who saw industrialists as robber barons, Schumpeter viewed entrepreneurs as heroic figures whose ambitions to conquer, fight, and show themselves superior drove economic advancement. These visionaries secure bank loans to acquire resources for creating new products, revolutionizing industries through waves of innovation. This process of creative destruction explains capitalism's boom and bust cycles. New technologies constantly replace old ones as companies rise and fall. Unlike conventional economists who viewed monopolies negatively, Schumpeter argued they incentivize innovation by offering entrepreneurs substantial rewards for risky ventures. Game theory emerged in the 1940s and 1950s to analyze strategic interactions where one party's decisions affect another's outcomes. The arms race exemplifies this. When one country buys missiles, it disadvantages the other, creating a cycle of mutual armament. John Nash, while still a Princeton student, developed the revolutionary concept of Nash equilibrium, the outcome where each player makes their best move given what others do. The prisoner's dilemma illustrates this perfectly. Two gangsters, separately questioned, must decide whether to confess or deny robbing a bank. Though mutual denial yields the best collective outcome, 4 years each, the equilibrium is mutual confession, 10 years each, because betraying your partner always offers a better individual outcome, regardless of what they choose. This paradox, rational individual decisions leading to suboptimal collective outcomes, appears throughout economics. Companies like General Electric and Westinghouse faced it when attempting price agreements, as did oil-producing countries trying to limit production. Game theory helps analyze when people compete versus cooperate and how threats function in sequential decisions. Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky pioneered behavioral economics by demonstrating that people don't make decisions with perfect rationality, but rather through a mental fog that distorts perception. Their research revealed that humans weigh gains and losses differently, a phenomenon called loss aversion, where people feel losses more intensely than equivalent gains. Richard Thaler's experiment demonstrated this by showing that people who received a mug valued it much higher than those asked to buy the identical mug, contradicting traditional economic theory that assumes consistent valuations regardless of ownership. This occurs because outcomes are judged relative to our starting reference point, making us reluctant to give up what we already possess. People's decisions are heavily influenced by their reference points. Just as a room seems lighter or darker depending on outside brightness, outcomes look better or worse depending on where you start. Once you possess something, it becomes more valuable to you psychologically. Framing also matters. When Kahneman and Tversky presented identical health programs as either saving 200 people or 400 people dying from a disease threatening 600 lives, people preferred the first option despite identical outcomes. People consistently misjudge probabilities based on irrelevant information. When presented with a music-loving woman named Carol, most people incorrectly judge Carol is a bank clerk and plays saxophone in a local band as more likely than Carol is a bank clerk, despite the mathematical impossibility of a specific condition being more probable than a general one. Robert Shiller applied behavioral economics to explain the 1990s tech stock bubble, rejecting the efficient markets hypothesis. Rather than rationally evaluating company fundamentals, investors behaved like a fashion-driven herd, buying shares because others were doing so and prices kept rising. When the bubble burst in 2000, $2 trillion in wealth vanished within a week. Shiller noted this pattern resembled historical manias like the Dutch tulip bubble and correctly predicted the subsequent housing bubble that would threaten the entire financial system. Despite economists' poor reputation, especially after failing to predict the global financial crisis, economics has achieved important successes in solving specific problems. While critics argue economists oversimplify reality by assuming efficient markets and rational actors, economic principles have proven valuable in areas from kidney donation matching to addressing global warming. Alvin Roth revolutionized organ transplantation without introducing money into the system. Recognizing that many willing kidney donors can't help their intended recipients due to incompatibility, Roth created a database-driven kidney exchange system that identifies beneficial swaps between patient-donor pairs. Using advanced mathematics and computer algorithms, his New England program for kidney exchange facilitated thousands of transplants that wouldn't have otherwise occurred. Global warming represents what William Nordhaus calls a double externality, a market failure extending across both space and time. Carbon emissions from one country affect the entire planet and future generations. Economic principles help determine the optimal level of emissions by balancing costs and benefits. Rather than mandating uniform reductions, economists recommend carbon taxes or trading permits that allow those who can reduce emissions cheaply to make larger cuts. Amartya Sen developed the capabilities approach to understanding poverty and development. Rather than measuring poverty by income alone, Sen focuses on people's abilities to function in society, being nourished, healthy, safe, and participating in community life. His Human Development Index, adopted by the United Nations, measures development through life expectancy and literacy alongside income. Sen also revolutionized famine theory, showing that starvation occurs not from food shortages, but from entitlement collapse, when people can't access available food due to unemployment or price spikes. Democracy and press freedom, he argues, are crucial safeguards against famines, as governments become accountable when journalists report suffering. History's economists develop different ideas responding to their time's problems. Economics isn't like mathematics. There's no permanently right answer. By understanding these diverse historical responses, we can develop new ideas to address today's economic challenges, extreme inequality, financial crises, global warming. Getting these solutions right means more people can live good lives. Getting them wrong means suffering for those unable to access necessities. Economics began with ancient Greek philosophers asking fundamental questions we still grapple with. What makes a good society? What do people need for happiness and fulfillment? What helps humans truly thrive? After all arguments and disagreements, economics must return to these essential questions.